Snow fell over Thornwick Hall on the night of the winter ball, soft and silent, dusting the carved stone lions that guarded the front steps. Inside, the house glowed gold. Candlelight climbed the walls of the great ballroom and pooled across a floor of polished marble, and a string quartet bent over their instruments near the far wall, drawing out a waltz that floated above the heads of 200 guests. Champagne caught the light in delicate towers of glass. Diamonds flashed at throats. Laughter rose and fell like a tide that never reached the people who scrubbed the floors beneath it. Below all that brightness, in the narrow stone passage that ran behind the kitchens, Juliana Clark pressed her back against the wall and tried to slow her breathing. She was 22 years old, and she had spent 3 of those years learning the particular geography of Thornwick Hall, which floorboards groaned, which doors stuck in damp weather, which corridors led nowhere a lady's maid should be found after dark. She had learned to walk without being seen. She had learned that a servant's safety depended on one rule, repeated to her on her very first day by the housekeeper, Mrs. Adeline Robinson. Be useful. Be quiet. Be unnoticed. Tonight she had broken that rule, and she already understood she would pay for it. It had started with a note. Lady Cordelia Faulkner, the woman Juliana served, and the woman all of society expected to become the next Duchess of Winthorpe, had asked Juliana to carry a message to the estate steward's office regarding a missing shipment of wine for the ball. Juliana had knocked. No one had answered. The door had been unlatched, swinging open at the lightest push, and there on the desk, beside a half-burned candle, lay a ledger bound in dark leather, open to a page that did not belong in any household account book she had ever seen. She should have closed it. She should have left. Instead, she had stepped closer, because the second line on the page bore a name she knew. Phoebe Wallace. Phoebe, who had scrubbed floors beside her for 2 years. Phoebe, who had been dismissed 5 months ago without a reference, accused of theft she had not committed, sent away with nothing but the clothes on her back, and a debt Juliana still did not understand. Beside Phoebe's name was a sum of money, a date, and a single word in tight, careful handwriting. Settled. Juliana had turned the page. More names. Clara Goodwin. Eliza. A kitchen maid called Mabel, who had vanished from the household the previous spring, and whom nobody had been permitted to ask about twice. Beside each name, numbers. Beside some, the word interview, underlined. She had not understood the full shape of what she was looking at. She had understood enough. Her mother had taught her, long before Thornwick Hall, that the world divided itself cleanly into people permitted to ask questions and people expected to absorb whatever answer they were given. Juliana had spent 3 years proving herself among the second sort, folding gowns without comment, carrying secrets up and down servants' stairs without ever repeating them, learning the particular silence that kept a roof over her mother's head. She had told herself, more times than she could count, that this silence was simply the price of safety. Looking down at Phoebe's name beside that cold, bloodless word, she understood for the first time how much that silence had truly cost, and how many women had paid it without ever being asked whether they agreed to the price. Her hands had moved before her mind had finished deciding, and she had torn a single page free and pushed it into the tight sleeve of her dress, and she had been turning to leave when Charles Holloway's voice had reached her from the doorway, mild and pleasant, the way a man's voice is mild and pleasant when he already knows he has won. "Miss Clark," he had said, "you are a long way from Lady Cordelia's rooms." Charles Holloway was not a large man, nor a loud one, and that was what made him dangerous. He managed the estate's accounts, its wages, its dismissals, and its references, and in 3 years Juliana had watched him use that small, quiet authority, the way other men used a fist. He had stepped into the office and closed the door with the gentlest click, and he had told her, in the same mild voice, that she had misunderstood what she'd seen. That household ledgers were complicated things, that a maid without a reference was a maid without a future, and that her mother's cottage on the edge of the estate existed only as long as the Duke's steward found no reason to mention the tenancy to anyone. Juliana had stood very still while he spoke, listening to the particular rhythm of a man who had said similar things to other frightened women many times before, who had learned exactly which words landed hardest, and which pauses let fear do the rest of his work for him. She understood, with a cold and sudden clarity, that this was not the first time Charles Holloway had stood this close to someone smaller than himself, and made the walls of the room feel smaller still. "Give me what you took," he had said, "and we need not speak of this again." Juliana had felt the torn page against her wrist like a brand. She had thought of Phoebe, sleeping in a borrowed room two counties away, because no one in this house would vouch for her. She had said no. What followed had happened too quickly for her to fully understand even now, crouched in the dark passage with her pulse roaring in her ears. Charles had taken hold of her wrist. She had pulled back. They had struggled near the head of the servant's stair, and his hand had found her shoulder and shoved, and the world had tipped sideways, and she had fallen. She did not remember every step of the fall. She remembered the cold edge of stone catching her ankle. She remembered the white flash of pain that swallowed every other thought. She remembered lying at the bottom of the stair in the dark, alone, because Charles Holloway had already walked away, unhurried, certain that a servant girl with a twisted ankle and no witnesses was no threat to a man who controlled every reference in the county. Now Juliana dragged herself upright against the wall of the passage, her right leg refusing to bear weight, fire running from her ankle to her knee with every small movement. She understood, with the cold clarity that comes only in true danger, that if she stayed in this corridor, Charles could say anything about her, that she had stolen from his office, that she had fled the house, that she had never been seen again. There was only one place in Thornwick Hall where 200 witnesses stood close enough together to make a lie difficult. She began to crawl toward the ballroom. The journey should have taken her a minute. It took much longer than that, because her leg would not obey her, because the marble floor near the ballroom entrance was cold enough to numb her palms, because every few feet she had to stop and press her forehead to the stone and tell herself that she was almost there. The music grew louder as she neared the archway. Laughter spilled out to meet her, bright and careless, utterly indifferent to the girl crawling toward it with a torn hem and a bleeding palm. She reached the edge of the dance floor just as the waltz ended, and the silence that followed the music was the silence in which she finally collapsed, her hands sliding against polished marble, her ankle giving way completely beneath her. The pain tore a sound out of her that she had not meant to make. "It hurts," she sobbed to the room, to the chandeliers, to anyone. "I cannot walk." For one terrible moment, nothing happened at all. Then the room began to move, and not toward her. A woman in violet silk drew her skirts aside, as though Juliana's presence might stain them. A man near the punch table said, loudly enough to be heard, that the girl had clearly had too much wine smuggled up from below stairs. Lady Cordelia, 3 feet away with a fan still raised to her face, looked at Juliana with an expression of pure, helpless embarrassment, and then looked away toward the safety of a conversation that had nothing to do with her maid bleeding on the floor. Juliana lay against the cold marble and felt something inside her crack quietly open, a small and bitter understanding settling into place beside the pain in her leg. She had known, in some abstract way, that the people she served considered her invisible. She had not understood, until this exact moment, how completely that invisibility could survive even the sight of her own blood on their floor. 3 years of curtsies and careful silence, and not one person in this glittering room could spare her the smallest measure of the concern they would have shown a fallen dog. "Someone remove her," said a voice near the staircase, and Juliana recognized it as Mrs. Robinson's, tight with panic rather than cruelty, though the effect was the same. "Before His Grace arrives, quickly, before he sees." 2 footmen started forward. Juliana looked up through the tangle of her own loosened hair and saw, at the top of the grand staircase, the Duke of Winthorpe. She had served in this house for 3 years and had spoken perhaps a dozen words to him in all that time. Gideon Kensington was known in every drawing room in England as a man carved from discipline rather than feeling, cold, exact, untouched by scandal, married to duty in a way that made actual marriage seem almost beside the point. He had inherited a damaged estate and a war's worth of grief, and had spent a decade making certain neither showed. Servants did not fear him because he was cruel. They feared him because he noticed everything and forgave nothing that fell short of correct. He stood now at the top of the stairs in black evening dress, and his gaze moved once across the ballroom, across the footmen advancing, across Mrs. Robinson's raised hand, across the murmurs already curling into laughter, and stopped on the girl on the floor. Juliana watched something change in his face. Not softness, something colder and more dangerous than softness, like the moment before ice cracks under weight. He came down the stairs slowly, slowly enough that every person in that ballroom understood he had heard every word spoken since the music stopped. "No one moves her," he said, and his voice was not loud, but it reached every corner of the room the way the music had, and the footmen stopped where they stood as if the floor itself had ordered them to. He crossed the marble and knelt beside her, in his black coat, on the floor where dukes did not kneel, and the silken diamonds around them went very still. His hand hovered near her shoulder. He did not touch her without asking. "Miss Clark," he said, "may I help you?" She had not known he remembered her name. The shock of it loosened something in her chest that pain alone had not been able to reach. "Please," she whispered, "do not let him take me back." She watched his eyes move past her, to the wrist she had cradled against her body, to the torn cuff of her sleeve, to a single dark button, broken from its thread, lying near her hand on the marble, a button that did not belong to any servant's livery. Something in his expression went very still, and very quiet, in the particular way a man goes quiet when he is choosing, with great care, not to show how angry he has become. He lifted her himself. Servants did not carry maids out of ballrooms. Dukes did not kneel on cold floors for girls who scrubbed their linens. Juliana felt the eyes of 200 guests on her, like heat against her skin, as Gideon rose with her weight settled against his chest, careful of her injured leg, and turned toward the doors that led from the ballroom. He paused only once, and looked across the room to where Charles Holloway stood near the edge of the crowd, his face arranged into careful concern, his hands clasped behind his back as though he had only just arrived to witness the commotion. "Mr. Holloway," Gideon said, in a voice that did not rise and did not need to, "you will remain in this house until I have spoken with you." Then he carried Juliana from the ballroom, and the music, after a long, uncertain pause, began again behind them, as though nothing at all had happened. Juliana pressed her face briefly against the cool wool of his coat, and felt, for the first time in 3 years inside that house, something close to safety. It frightened her more than the fall had. She had built her entire survival in this house around the certainty that no one above stairs would ever choose her over their own comfort. That certainty had just been carried out of a ballroom in a Duke's Arms, and she did not yet know what to put in its place. Behind them, through the closing doors, she could hear the orchestra finding its rhythm again, the laughter rising once more, as though the room itself were eager to forget what it had just refused to see. Juliana let her eyes close against the steady, unhurried rise and fall of Gideon's breathing, and for the length of the corridor at least, she allowed herself to stop calculating how much this small mercy might eventually cost her. She did not yet know that the Duke believed something was deeply wrong, long before she had told him a single word of the truth. She would learn it within the hour. For now, she only knew that someone, for once in her life, had looked at her pain and chosen to kneel. "Hey, quick question. How are you feeling today?" "Thank you so much for being here. It really means the world to me. I'm working toward 10,000 subscribers, and if Juliana's story is already pulling at your heart, please hit that subscribe button for this channel, smash the like, and drop a comment telling me where you're watching from. It helps more than you know." "All right. Thank you. Now let's get back to what happens when the maid everyone ignored becomes the one woman a duke refuses to stop believing." Juliana woke to firelight. For a moment she did not know where she was, and the not knowing was almost pleasant. A soft bed beneath her, linen sheets, smelling faintly of lavender water. A fire burning low and steady in a marble hearth far grander than any she had slept near before. Heavy curtains held back a storm she could hear, but not see. A tray sat untouched on a side table, a thin curl of steam still rising from a teapot. Then her ankle throbbed, and memory returned all at once. The ledger, Charles's hand on her wrist, the fall, the ballroom floor, the Duke kneeling in his black coat, while the music stopped. She sat up too quickly and regretted it. "You should not move yet," said a voice from the doorway, and a man she did not recognize came forward, his sleeves still rolled from work, a leather case open on the table beside him. "Dr. Benedict Sterling, I have set your ankle and bound it. It is a severe sprain, not a break, though you will need to keep off it for some days." Juliana's first instinct, the one trained into her over 3 years of service, rose before she could stop it. "Your Grace, I should not be here," she said, though the Duke was nowhere in sight, as though the apology belonged to the room itself. It was Dr. Sterling who answered, with a small, tired smile, gathering his instruments. "His Grace gave very particular instructions about that. I'll let him explain them himself. He has been waiting to know when you woke." The physician left, and a few minutes later Gideon entered, and Juliana understood immediately that he had not slept. His cravat had been loosened at some point in the night, and not retied. His dark hair was disordered in a way that no valet would have permitted had he been seen by anyone he wished to impress. He carried himself, even now, with the same careful control she remembered from the ballroom, but there was a rawness beneath it that had not been there before. He took the chair beside the bed, not too close, and studied her face as though checking for pain she might try to hide. "You are in a guest chamber in my private wing," he said, before she could apologize again. "You are here because you were injured under my roof, and I did not consider it acceptable to send you elsewhere to be questioned by people who had already decided not to believe you." Juliana studied him in the low firelight. This man, whose name she had heard whispered with caution for 3 years, and tried to reconcile the stories with the quiet, exhausted figure seated beside her bed. She had been told he never raised his voice because he did not need to, that men twice his size grew careful in his presence, that his late father had named him heir over an elder cousin, precisely because Gideon alone seemed incapable of being moved by sentiment. None of that explained the man who had not slept, who had given orders to protect a servant girl's dignity before he had even confirmed what had happened to her, who sat now, with his hands loosely folded, as though he were the one waiting for permission to speak further. The household will talk, Juliana said quietly. They will say I have been brought here for... She stopped because she did not know how to finish the sentence without insulting either his honor or her own. They may say what they like, Gideon said. I have given orders. Only Dr. Sterling and Mrs. Robinson may enter this room without your leave. No servant is to question you about tonight. Mr. Holloway is confined to his quarters until I have finished my inquiries. Your wages will continue whether or not you are fit to work for some time. Juliana stared at him. In 3 years, she had learned to expect many things from the great families she served. Indifference, impatience, the occasional flash of casual cruelty that powerful people rarely noticed in themselves. She had not learned to expect this, a man arranging the boundaries of her safety as carefully as he might arrange the defense of an estate, and then waiting, visibly uncertain, to see whether she found it sufficient. Why, she asked, before caution could stop her, would you do all this for a lady's maid? Something moved behind his eyes, not quite pain, not quite anger, something that lived in the narrow space between the two. Because I came down a staircase tonight, he said, and watched 200 people decide that your pain was an inconvenience rather than an emergency. I find I cannot unsee that, Miss Clark, no matter how many of them would prefer that I could. He did not move to touch her. He had not touched her at all since lifting her from the ballroom floor, and Juliana noticed it the way one notices the absence of a sound one has grown used to. When he adjusted the blanket near her foot, he paused first, his hand hovering, and only continued when she gave the smallest nod. What would make you feel safe enough to tell me what happened? He asked. No one had ever asked her that question. Not once in 3 years had anyone in this house inquired what Juliana needed before deciding what she would receive. She found, to her own surprise, that the question undid something in her more thoroughly than any threat Charles Holloway had made. It was such a small question in the end, 5 plain words, asked in a quiet room, with no audience to perform for, and nothing to gain by asking it. And yet Juliana could not remember the last time anyone had paused before her, even for a moment, to wonder what she required rather than what she could provide. Her mother asked her, sometimes, in the rare letters that reached her between quarters. No one inside Thornwick Hall ever had. She felt tears rise, unbidden and unwelcome, and pressed the back of her hand briefly against her eyes before she trusted herself to speak. Gideon did not press her further that first evening. He left her to rest, and the days that followed settled into a careful, watchful rhythm. Mrs. Robinson came each morning to check on her, formal and tight-lipped, insisting in a brisk voice that Thornwick Hall had always run as a respectable household, and that whatever had happened to Juliana was an aberration. Nothing more. Juliana, still too sore to argue at length, said only that respectability mattered little if the people inside a house were too frightened to speak honestly about it. Mrs. Robinson left each time with her jaw set and her eyes carefully averted, and Juliana noticed, without yet understanding why, that the housekeeper's hands trembled faintly when she folded the linens at the foot of the bed. It was on the third night that Juliana woke past midnight to find Gideon asleep in the chair beside the fire. He had not meant to stay so long. She understood that all, that much from the awkward angle of his neck against the chair's high back, the way his cravat had loosened itself sometime in the late hours. The candle on the table beside him burned down to a stub. One hand rested near the edge of her blanket, close enough to reach her instantly should she wake in pain, careful enough never to have touched her, without leave, even while he slept. Juliana lay very still and watched him for a long moment. This man the entire county described as cold and unreachable, breathing slow and unguarded in the firelight. Exhaustion stripping away every careful, disciplined line he wore like armor during the day. She thought, with a small ache she did not examine too closely, that she had never once in 3 years seen a powerful man look this unprotected, and that something in her wanted, foolishly, to be the only person who ever saw him this way. He woke the instant she shifted, the way soldiers wake, fully alert before his eyes had even port properly opened. "Are you in pain?" he asked, already leaning forward. "You stayed," Juliana said, instead of answering. "You were frightened," Gideon said simply, as though that explained everything that needed explaining, and perhaps, between the two of them, it did. Neither of them spoke of it again the next morning, though Juliana found herself returning to the memory of it often in the days that followed, the particular quiet warmth of being watched over by someone who asked nothing in return for the watching. It was 2 nights after that the deeper conversation finally came, the one Juliana had been circling for days without quite finding the courage to begin. She told him about the ledger first, carefully, watching his face for the disbelief she had braced herself for, and that did not come. She told him about Phoebe, dismissed without reference for a theft Juliana did not believe she had committed. She told him about Clara, about Eliza, about the kitchen maid called Mabel, who had simply stopped existing in the household one spring morning. She told him, finally, about the page she had torn free and hidden in her sleeve before Charles had cornered her, and she drew it now from beneath the blanket where she had kept it pressed against her side, even through the fall, even through the carrying, even through sleep. Gideon took the page and read it in silence, and Juliana watched the muscles along his jaw tighten as his eyes moved down the column of names, the sums, the single chilling word, "settled," repeated again and again like a verdict no one had asked the women themselves to agree to. Then his gaze stopped, and his expression changed in a way Juliana could not immediately name. Not anger at Charles. Something colder turned inward. "What is it?" she asked. "These initials," Gideon said quietly, his finger resting beside two letters written small in the column's corner. "They are my father's." The fire cracked in the grate. Outside, the storm pressed against the windows. "This did not begin with Mr. Holloway," Gideon said, and his voice had gone very flat, the way a man's voice goes flat when he is holding something enormous very still so that it will not break apart in his hands. "Whatever he has done in my house, he did not invent the silence that let him do it." Juliana watched him sit with that knowledge, watched the careful, disciplined Duke she had heard described for 3 years come apart at one small seam, and she understood, with sudden and uncomfortable clarity, that the danger she had stumbled into reached far beyond one cruel steward and his ledger. She also understood, lying in a stranger's bed in a stranger's private wing, with this man's exhausted, furious, gentle attention turned fully toward her, for what felt like the first time in her life, she understood that she was no longer entirely afraid. She was something else now, something warmer, and far more dangerous to her peace of mind. The week that followed moved at two speeds at once. Thornwick Hall itself seemed unsettled by the change, as though the great house had grown so accustomed to its own quiet corruption that the first stirrings of investigation registered, somewhere in its old stones, as a kind of fever. Maids who had once hurried past Charles Holloway's office with their eyes lowered now found small reasons to linger nearby, listening. Footmen who had served the family for decades exchanged glances over the dinner trays they carried, sensing, without yet being told, that something fundamental in the household's order had begun to shift. Even the weather seemed to conspire with the mood of the house. The storm that had broken on the night of the ball did not entirely clear for days afterward, leaving the grounds wrapped in a low gray mist that crept along the hedgerows each morning and lingered in the hollows of the drive until well past noon. Juliana watched it from her sitting room window and thought, not unkindly, that Thornwick Hall seemed to be holding its breath alongside her, waiting to discover what manner of house it would become once the truth had finally finished working its way through every locked drawer and careful silence within its walls. Beneath the surface of Thornwick Hall, the investigation gathered pace, like water rising behind a dam. Gideon brought in his cousin William Kensington, a sharp, quiet man who asked questions no one thought to refuse a duke's relative, and the family solicitor, Arthur Stirling, brother to the physician who had set Juliana's ankle. Together the three men began working through years of household ledgers by candlelight, and what they found told a story far larger than one ruined maid's testimony. Wages quietly reduced for women who had displeased certain guests, letters of reference forged or simply never written, leaving dismissed servants unable to find honest work anywhere in the county. Accusations of theft that traced back, every time, to a girl who had refused something Charles Holloway had arranged on someone else's behalf. And running through it all, again and again, a name that made Gideon's hand still over the page, each time he found it. Lord Sebastian Faulkner, brother to Lady Cordelia, recorded as the source of payment for no fewer than 6 private interviews with servant girls who no longer worked at Thornwick Hall. Above the surface, in the slower rhythm of the house's daily life, Juliana healed. She spent her days in the guest chamber at first. Then, as her strength returned, in a small private sitting room near Gideon's own study, where Mrs. Robinson brought her meals with an expression that softened by careful degrees from cold formality into something closer to shame. Thornwick Hall has always been a respectable house, Mrs. Robinson said one afternoon, setting down a tray with more force than necessary, as though daring Juliana to contradict her. Respectability means little, Juliana said quietly, if the people who keep your house in order are too frightened to tell you the truth about it. Mrs. Robinson left without answering, but she did not look angry. She looked for the first time since Juliana had known her, afraid of something other than her own position. It was William who found Phoebe, 2 counties away, working in a draper's shop under a name that was not quite her own. Phoebe arrived at Thornwick Hall 3 days later, trembling so badly that Dr. Stirling insisted she rest before anyone questioned her, and when she finally spoke, she confirmed everything the ledger had only implied. Charles Holloway had threatened to ruin her mother's good name in the village if she did not agree to a private appointment with a guest whose title made his behavior, in Charles's words, no one's business but his own. She had refused. She had been dismissed within the week, accused of theft she had never committed, sent away with no reference, and a debt to the estate that existed only on paper. She had kept 2 letters in Charles's own hand. They were enough, with the ledger, to turn a single maid's accusation into the unmistakable shape of a pattern. When Juliana finally saw Phoebe again, the 2 women embraced for a long moment without speaking. And Juliana felt, beneath her own relief, a fresh wave of the anger that had been building quietly in her since the night of the ball. Phoebe had grown thinner in the months since her dismissal, and there was a wariness in her now that had not been there before, a habit of glancing toward doors before she finished a sentence. I thought no one would ever ask me to tell the truth of it, Phoebe admitted, her voice low. I thought I would carry it alone for the rest of my days. Juliana held her friend's hands and promised, with more certainty than she entirely felt, that she would not carry it alone any longer. It was during this slow accumulation of evidence that Juliana first noticed how carefully Gideon was holding himself at a distance from her, and how poorly the distance seemed to suit either of them. One morning, before the rest of the household had stirred, he found her attempting to cross the small sitting room without her cane, gritting her teeth against the protest of her healing ankle. You will undo a week of Dr. Stirling's work, he said, though there was no real reproach in it. I am tired of being carried from room to room, Juliana said. I would like, once, to walk into a room on my own feet. Something in his face shifted at that. Recognition, perhaps, of a feeling he understood better than she expected. "Then let me walk you to the conservatory," he said. "It is quiet there before the household wakes. No one will see if you stumble." The conservatory at dawn was a world apart from the rest of Thornwick Hall, frost feathering the glass panes, the damp green smell of winter roses, pale light easing slowly across the tiled floor. Juliana leaned on her cane and made her way between the beds of sleeping plants, while Gideon walked half a step behind, his hands clasped carefully behind his back, ready and not reaching. She had grown, in these quiet mornings, almost fond of the particular silence between them. Not the silence of fear she had learned to keep with every other person of rank in this house, but something gentler, companionable. Full of words, neither of them yet trusted themselves to say aloud. She found herself noticing things about him she had no business noticing. The way frostlight caught the grey, just beginning at his temples. The low, unhurried cadence of his voice when he forgot. For a Ithul moment, to guard it. The careful and deliberate way he always positioned himself slightly behind her, rather than beside her, as though he understood, without being told, that she needed to feel she was leading rather than being led. She stumbled near a low stone urn, her ankle buckling without warning, and his hand caught her arm before she had even finished falling. "May I?" he asked, low, his hand still hovering rather than settling, waiting for her answer, even with her balance already gone. She nodded, because there was nothing else to do, and because some reckless, unguarded part of her wanted to feel his hand at her waist far more than caution thought-wise. His palm settled against her side, warm even through the layers of her dress, and Juliana became abruptly and acutely aware of how close he stood, close enough that she could smell cedar and rain on his coat, close enough to feel the careful, deliberate stillness of his breathing, as though he were counting each one to keep it even. "Better?" he asked. "Yes," she said, though her own breath had gone shorter than the short walk could explain. He withdrew his hand a moment later, almost too quickly, as though he had caught himself wanting to leave it there. Juliana told herself, walking the rest of the path on her own power, that she imagined the warmth that lingered where his hand had been. She told herself the same thing again that night, lying awake long after the fire had burned down, and did not believe it any better the second time. She pressed her own palm flat against the place at her waist where his hand had rested, as though she might still find the shape of his fingers there, and felt, with a small and helpless flush of feeling, how thoroughly her body had begun to keep its own private record of him, the warmth, the restraint, the careful, deliberate slowness with which he touched her, as though she were something rare enough to require patience rather than haste. She had been touched carelessly before, by guests who forgot servants had skin that bruised, by Charles Holloway's grasping, ugly hand on her wrist. She had never before been touched as though the person touching her were memorizing the experience of being permitted to. It frightened her, this particular hunger settling low and quiet beneath her ribs. She had nothing to offer a duke beyond gratitude, and gratitude, she had learned early in life, made for a very poor foundation upon which to build wanting. And yet the wanting persisted, stubborn and unhurried, through every quiet morning that followed. The fragile, careful peace of those mornings ended 3 days later, when Lord Sebastian Faulkner arrived at Thornwick Hall. He came smiling, charming, dressed in the easy confidence of a man who had never once in his life doubted that doors would open for him, and he greeted Gideon in the study with the warmth of old friendship before turning, almost as an afterthought, to the subject that had truly brought him. "I understand there has been some unpleasantness with a servant girl," Sebastian said, settling into a chair without invitation. "I wished to offer my support, as your friend, before the matter grows into something neither of us can easily manage." There is no unpleasantness, Gideon said. There is a crime, and I intend to see it answered. Sebastian's smile did not waver, though something behind it sharpened. Of course. And I admire your principle, Gideon, truly. But you must consider how this appears. A maid recovering in your private wing, weeks before your understanding with my sister, is meant to be formally announced. People will say things. They will say them whether the things are true or not. For her sake as much as yours, perhaps she ought to be sent somewhere quieter, somewhere safer. She is already safe, Gideon said. Here. Sebastian leaned forward then, his voice dropping into something colder and more deliberate. I know what is written in that ledger you've been so quietly reading, Gideon. I would think carefully about how loudly you wish to discuss it. A man's name, once spoken aloud in the wrong room, is very difficult to take back. He left soon after, still smiling, and Gideon sat alone in his study for a long while after the door had closed, turning the threat over in his mind with the same careful attention he gave to every danger that threatened his house. It was past midnight when he finally returned to the ledger himself, cross-referencing the column of payments against Sebastian's own household accounts, which William had quietly obtained through a contact in the man's bank. The pattern, once Gideon allowed himself to see it clearly, was unmistakable. Sebastian Faulkner's name did not appear in that ledger as a man wronged by Charles Holloway's schemes. It appeared as the source of the money. Gideon sat with that knowledge until the candle burned low, understanding, with the particular dread of a man watching his own foundations crack, that exposing the truth Juliana had handed him in a torn page might cost him every political alliance, every easy friendship, and possibly the very marriage society had already arranged in his name. He found that he no longer cared, and the discovery frightened him more than Sebastian's threat had. The advisers came one by one, as Gideon had known they would, each with the same quiet suggestion, dressed in different words. Arthur Sterling spoke of legal exposure and the difficulty of prosecuting a man as well connected as Charles Holloway, without risking the estate's own reputation. A trustee, summoned from London, spoke of tenants who depended on Sebastian Faulkner's railway investments and the harm that might come to them if that alliance collapsed in scandal. Even William, loyal as he was, suggested that Charles might simply be permitted to resign quietly, that Juliana might be given a sum of money and a fresh start somewhere far from Thornwick Hall, that the ledger might disappear into a locked drawer where it could trouble no one. Gideon listened to all of it, and understood, with a clarity that settled in his chest like cold water, that this was precisely how men like Charles Holloway were protected for years at a time, not by villains acting alone, but by 100 reasonable men making 100 reasonable compromises, each one small enough to seem harmless. He went to Juliana's sitting room that evening intending to offer her the only solution his advisers had left him with, and found, even as he spoke the words, that he did not believe in them. There is a cottage, he said, on one of my estates in the north, quiet, comfortable. You would be safe there, and far from any talk that might follow what is coming. Juliana set down the embroidery she had been using to occupy her healing hands, and looked at him for a long moment before she answered. You mean to send me away? I mean to protect you. You mean, she said, and her voice had gone very steady, very careful, the voice of a woman, choosing each word with the precision of someone who has rarely been permitted to choose anything at all, to move me from one room to another, the way I have been moved my whole life, so that other people need not look at what was done to me. I have spent years being told where I may stand, and how quietly I must suffer, so that someone else's comfort remains undisturbed. I will not be hidden away, so your guests may keep pretending nothing happened in this house. Gideon stood very still. Something in his face changed slowly, like a man recognizing with great reluctance his own reflection in an unflattering light. "I nearly did to you," he said quietly. "Exactly what I despise in every other man who has decided what was best for you without once asking what you wanted." "Yes," Juliana said, "you did." He did not defend himself, and that, more than any apology, was what finally loosened the tight knot of fear in Juliana's chest. He simply stood with the weight of his own mistake, accepting it without flinching, and said, "Then tell me what you want instead." "I want to stay," she said. "I want the truth told in a room too large for anyone to quietly bury it. I want Charles Holloway answerable to a magistrate, not merely dismissed to trouble some other house." "Then that is what will happen," Gideon said, "whatever it costs." The air between them had changed by then, charged with something neither of them named. Gideon took a step closer, near enough that Juliana could see the effort it cost him to keep his hands at his sides. She could feel her own pulse in her throat, in her wrists, in the strange, light-headed space behind her ribs. The fire had burned down to embers, throwing only the faintest gold across the room. And in that low light, Gideon's eyes had gone darker than she had ever seen them, fixed on her with an intensity that made her suddenly acutely aware of how close together they were standing, of how little space remained between his chest and her own. She did not step back. She told herself afterward that she had simply forgotten how. "You have no idea," he said, low, "how difficult you make restraint." Juliana's breath caught. She felt the pull of him like warmth from a fire she had not realized she was standing near, and for one suspended moment, she wanted nothing in the world so much as to close the small distance still left between them. He did not move to kiss her. He looked instead at her mouth for one unguarded second, and then deliberately, visibly, returned his gaze to her eyes. "Would you like me to leave?" he asked. "No," she said, before she could stop herself. He left anyway, and at the door he paused long enough to say without turning, "Until you are free to choose this without fear of what you owe me, I will not ask you for anything more than your trust." Juliana sat alone afterward, with her pulse still unsteady, and understood that his restraint, far from disappointing her, had taught her something she had never been permitted to learn in 3 years of service, that wanting someone did not have to mean surrendering herself to be wanted. It was Lady Cordelia who sought her out the following afternoon, arriving at the sitting room with her chin raised and her voice sharp with a hurt she did not quite manage to hide. "You believe yourself very clever," Cordelia said, recovering in his private wing while the entire county whispers about it. "I believe myself fortunate to be alive, my lady," Juliana said, "which is more than your brother intended for me." Cordelia's composure flickered. "My brother has done nothing. Your brother paid Mr. Holloway for access to women who had no power to refuse him," Juliana said quietly. "I do not say this to wound you. I say it because you too are being used, expected to marry a duke for political advantage, while your own brother's corruption is kept hidden from you as carefully as it was kept from everyone else." Cordelia did not answer for a long moment, and when she finally spoke, the sharpness had gone out of her voice entirely. "I do not want his title," she said quietly, meaning Gideon, meaning the marriage neither of them had ever truly chosen. "I never have." She left without apologizing, but something in her bearing had changed, and Juliana understood that the first seed of doubt had been planted where it mattered most. That same evening, Mrs. Robinson came to Juliana's door long after the rest of the household had gone to bed, her hands twisting in her apron, her face pale in the candlelight. "I obeyed him," she said, without preamble. "Mr. Holloway. He told me which girls to dismiss and gave me no reasons I was permitted to ask for, and I obeyed, because I feared losing my own position if I did not." Her voice broke. I have carried that fear for years, Miss Clark, and watching you on that ballroom floor, I understood at last what my obedience had cost. There are duplicate records. He kept them in the old linen room behind the west stair, in case he ever needed proof against his own employers. I will show you, if you wish it. They found the records that night. Gideon, Juliana, William, and Mrs. Robinson, moving by candlelight through a dust-thick room that had not been opened in years. Among the duplicate ledgers, carefully preserved as Charles Holloway's own insurance against discovery, was a sealed letter addressed to no one, dated the very night of the winter ball. Gideon broke the seal and read it in silence, and when he looked up, his face had gone the color of ash. "He knew you had seen the ledger before you ever reached the corridor," he said quietly. "This was no accident, Juliana. He planned to make certain you never reached anyone who would believe you." The fire in the old linen room burned low, and outside the narrow window the winter night pressed close and cold, and Juliana understood, with a chill that had nothing to do with the temperature, that the danger she had survived was only the beginning of what Charles Holloway had been willing to do to keep his silence safe. Rain struck the tall windows of the great dining hall the night Gideon called the household to account, and the portraits of dead dukes looked down from the dark paneled walls as though they, too, had come to witness what their descendants would do with the truth. Juliana had spent the hour before in her sitting room, fastening the small buttons of her gown with hands that would not quite steady themselves, rehearsing the words she meant to say until they began to lose their meaning from repetition. She had stood in front of the narrow looking glass longer than she meant to, studying the woman reflected there, not a maid any longer, not quite, though she had not yet earned whatever word came next. She had thought of Phoebe, of Clara, of Eliza, of the kitchen maid called Mabel, who would never stand in this room to speak for herself, and she had understood that her own fear, however real, was a small enough thing to carry into a dining hall for their sake. The room had been arranged like a court, though no one called it that aloud. Estate trustees sat along one side of the long table. The local magistrate occupied a chair near its head. Arthur and Benedict Stirling stood near the hearth. Lord Sebastian Faulkner had taken a seat with the easy confidence of a man certain his name still protected him, and beside him, Lady Cordelia sat with her hands folded tightly in her lap, and her eyes fixed somewhere past her brother's shoulder. Charles Holloway stood near the far wall, composed, his hands clasped behind him, the very picture of a wrongly accused man enduring an unjust ordeal. Mrs. Robinson stood near the servant's door, pale but present. Phoebe, Clara, and Eliza had been brought, at Gideon's quiet insistence, from wherever they had scattered to after their dismissals, and they stood together near the back of the room, like women bracing against a wind only they could feel. Juliana entered last, on Gideon's arm, in a modest gown of blue-gray wool rather than her servant's uniform, walking with the aid of a cane rather than being carried. She had insisted on this the morning before, with a quiet stubbornness Gideon had learned not to argue with. She would walk into that room. She would not be brought into it. The room noticed the difference. Juliana felt their eyes settle on her, some curious, some hostile, a few surprisingly kind, and she held her chin level and let Gideon's arm steady her only as far as her own legs allowed. Charles spoke first, when invited, and denied everything with the smooth, practiced calm of a man who had clearly rehearsed every line. "Miss Clark stole that ledger page herself," he said. "She fled in a panic and fell, as frightened thieves often do. The other girls were dismissed for honest cause, and I would remind this room that servants' testimony has rarely been considered reliable evidence in matters concerning their betters." His eyes flicked briefly to Gideon. "I would also gently suggest that His Grace's judgment, however well intentioned, may have been clouded by sympathy, toward an attractive young woman in distress. Sebastian rose to support him at once. "Gideon," he said, with the warm, reasonable tone of a man trying to save a friend from himself, "you must see how this appears. You have allowed personal feeling to interfere with the governance of your own estate." Cordelia's hands tightened in her lap. She said nothing, but her silence had a different quality now than it once had. It was Juliana's turn to speak, and she felt the room's attention land on her like weight. She had expected fear. What rose instead, once she began, was something steadier. "I did not steal that page to harm anyone," she said. "I took it because I recognized my friend's name beside a sum of money and a word that frightened me more than Mr. Holloway's hands on my wrist ever did." Settled, as though a woman's ruined future could be settled like an account. She did not describe the worst of what she knew in graphic terms. She did not need to. She described instead the machinery of it. Wages quietly reduced, references destroyed without explanation, mothers threatened with the loss of their cottages, sisters dismissed for crimes invented after the fact, every complaint dismissed in turn as hysteria, as ingratitude, as a servant forgetting her place. Her voice shook only once, near the beginning, when she spoke Phoebe's name aloud for the first time in that room full of trustees and titles. She paused, drew a steadying breath, and felt Gideon's hand tighten briefly around hers, where it rested on his arm, not pulling her forward, not urging her on, simply letting her know the support was there, should she need it. She did not need it for long. By the third sentence, her voice had found its own steady footing, built on 3 years of swallowed words, finally given somewhere honest to go. "Mr. Holloway did not depend on our silence," Juliana said, her voice carrying clearly now through the rain-loud room. "He depended on everyone else's comfort, on the fact that it was easier for every person in this house to believe a maid was lying than to believe a respectable man was not." The line landed in the silence that followed it like a stone dropped into still water. It was Mrs. Robinson who broke that silence, rising from her place near the door, with her hands no longer twisting, but folded firmly before her. "I obeyed his orders," she said, loudly enough for the trustees at the far end of the table to hear clearly. "I dismissed Phoebe Wallace and Clara Goodwin and the girl called Mabel on his instruction and without any honest cause that he ever gave me. I kept silent because I feared for my own position. I will not keep silent any longer." She named each girl in turn, and the duplicate records she had helped uncover were laid upon the table before the magistrate, and the careful appearance of household unity that Charles Holloway had spent years constructing came apart in the space of a few sentences. Sebastian made one final attempt, leaning toward Gideon with his voice pitched low enough to seem private and loud enough to be heard by everyone present. "Think of what you stand to lose, Gideon. Your alliances, your standing. Cordelia." Gideon looked at him for a long moment, and when he answered, his voice carried the particular stillness of a man who had already weighed every cost and found it acceptable. "A name that survives by making women afraid to speak," he said, "is not an inheritance, Sebastian. It is a debt. I will not go on paying it on my father's behalf, and I will certainly not go on paying it on yours." He turned to Cordelia, who met his eyes with something close to relief rather than grief. "I cannot in good conscience continue toward a marriage built on an alliance I no longer trust," he said gently. And Cordelia, to the visible shock of everyone but Juliana, inclined her head in something that looked almost like gratitude. The evidence, the ledger, the duplicate records, Phoebe's letters, Mrs. Robinson's testimony, passed into the magistrate's hands before the night was through, and Charles Holloway was taken from the dining hall in the custody of the law, his composure finally cracking into something uglier as the door closed behind him. But before he was led away entirely, he turned back once, and his eyes found Juliana, across the width of the room. "You have no idea," he said, "what you have set loose." The rain continued against the tall windows long after he had gone, and Gideon, standing beside Juliana in the wreckage of a household that had finally turned against its own silence, understood that Charles Holloway's threat had not been an idle one. Whatever protection had shielded that man for so many years had not come from Thornwick Hall alone. Justice, when it finally arrived, did not come as a single dramatic stroke. It came the way real consequences usually do, slowly, through paperwork and testimony, and the patient grinding of a system rarely kind to people without money, but moved, this time, by evidence too thorough to dismiss. Charles Holloway was charged with assault, fraud, and the systematic coercion of household servants, the duplicate ledgers, and Phoebe's letters providing exactly the pattern the magistrate needed to take the matter seriously. He lost his position, his residence, his pension, and every reference that might have carried him into another great house. And within the month, he stood before a court, answering for charges that would see him imprisoned rather than merely disgraced. Sebastian Faulkner's fall was quieter, but no less real. The financial records William had gathered, combined with the testimony already entered against the estate, stripped away the easy confidence he had always worn, like a second coat. He did not lose everything overnight. Men of his standing rarely did. But he lost the trust of the political allies who had once valued his name, and he lost, perhaps most painfully, his sister's loyalty. Cordelia distanced herself from him publicly within weeks, and though society murmured for a season about the scandal at Thornwick Hall, the murmurs settled, in time, into something closer to grudging respect for a duke who had chosen difficult truth over easy silence. Gideon did not believe his own conscience could be settled with anything so simple as Charles Holloway's prosecution, and he did not try to settle it that way. He established a protection fund for the household servants, with written contracts, guaranteed references after fair service, and an independent process for reporting grievances that did not pass through the hands of any single steward ever again. He funded quietly, and without his name attached unless Juliana chose to attach it, a cottage and training house near the village, a place where women dismissed from unsafe service could learn reading, household accounts, sewing, and the particular hard-won knowledge of their own employment rights. Mrs. Robinson kept her position at Thornwick Hall, though the household she now ran bore little resemblance to the one she had once been too frightened to question. She wrote, of her own accord, to the magistrate's office offering further testimony, should it ever be needed, and she visited the training house twice in its first month, bringing linens she had no obligation to provide, and staying longer each time than her duties strictly required. "This is not payment for what you suffered," he told Juliana, the day he showed her the deed. "It is a beginning, if you wish it to be." Juliana wished it. She chose, with Phoebe and Clara beside her, to run the training house herself, and in the weeks of preparation that followed, choosing furnishings, recruiting the first handful of students, arguing cheerfully with Phoebe over the proper way to teach household accounts, Juliana discovered something she had not expected to find at the end of so much fear. A future that belonged entirely to her, built by her own choices, rather than handed down by someone else's mercy. It was on an evening in early spring, with the cottage still smelling of fresh paint and damp wool and the rose soap Clara had insisted on for the washroom, that Gideon came to see the work nearly finished. He found Juliana standing at the window as the light went gold and then grey over the new garden, and for a long moment neither of them spoke. "I am proud of you," he said finally. "I do not need your pride," Juliana said, though there was no bitterness in it, only the plain truth of a woman who had built this herself. "No," Gideon agreed, "you do not. But I find I cannot stop feeling it regardless." The conversation that followed went somewhere neither of them had quite planned. Gideon spoke, haltingly at first, and then with more honesty than Juliana had ever heard from him, of a lifetime spent protecting a title and a history he had never chosen, of duty worn so long it had become indistinguishable from his own skin, until a girl crawling across a ballroom floor had forced him to ask what, exactly, all that careful duty had ever actually protected. "You have spent your whole life guarding an estate," Juliana said softly. "I think, for the first time, you have begun guarding people instead." His hand found hers where it rested on the windowsill, and neither of them pulled away. "I have wanted you," he said, the words coming slow and deliberate, the way every important thing he said came, "since the night I knelt beside you, and you trusted me with the truth before you had any reason to believe I would keep it safe. I have said nothing of it, because I would not have you mistake gratitude for desire, or safety for love. But I find I can carry the silence no longer, and I would rather risk your refusal than continue pretending I do not feel what I feel." He said it plainly, without the careful armor of a duke choosing his words for political safety, and Juliana understood that this confession had cost him something, that a man so long trained to guard every feeling had just handed her one of his most closely kept, without any certainty of what she might do with it. Juliana turned to face him fully. She had her own roof now, her own income, her own purpose carved out of the wreckage of what had nearly destroyed her. And she understood, standing in the dim gold light of her own front room, that whatever she chose next, she would choose it as a woman with the power to refuse. "Ask me then," she said. "May I kiss you?" Gideon asked, low and careful, the same restraint he had shown her in the conservatory, in the sitting room, in every moment since the ballroom floor. "Yes," Juliana whispered. He cupped her face with one hand, slow and unhurried, as though he had waited so long for this that he could not bring himself to rush even now that the waiting was finally over. Juliana's fingers curled into the front of his coat, and when his mouth finally met hers, it was nothing like the desperate, hungry thing she had half feared and half longed for in her weaker moments. It was deliberate. It was patient. It carried the full weight of months of careful distance finally allowed to close, and Juliana felt the slow, burning want she had refused to name for so long rise gently to the surface and meet his with equal restraint, equal hunger, held just barely in check. He drew back only far enough to look at her, his breath uneven despite his stillness, his eyes searching hers for any sign that she wished him to stop. She answered by drawing him back to her herself, and the second kiss carried less restraint than the first, though it remained even then gentle. A long, slow ache finally given permission to exist in the open rather than in stolen, guarded moments neither of them had been brave enough to claim. She felt the warmth of him through every layer of wool and linen between them, the steady, unhurried heat of a man who had learned at last that wanting could be patient and still be devastating. It was Gideon who finally pulled back, his forehead resting briefly against hers, his hand still warm against her jaw. "I did not come here intending that," he admitted, and there was something almost boyish in the rueful honesty of it. "I am glad you did, regardless," Juliana said. They might have stayed in that quiet, unguarded happiness longer, had a letter not arrived for Gideon the following morning, forwarded from London with the particular urgency reserved for news a man's enemies wished him to receive quickly. Someone in London, the letter informed him, had begun spreading word that the Duke of Winthorpe kept a former servant as his mistress under the polite fiction of a charitable project, and that the training house Juliana had built with her own hands and her own hard-won freedom was, in truth, nothing more than a convenient cover for scandal. Juliana read the letter twice and felt the old fear rise in her chest. Not fear of Gideon now, but fear of a world that still could not quite accept a woman like her being treated openly and without shame, as an equal rather than a secret. The rumor moved through London the way rumors of that kind always moved, quickly, eagerly, with far more interest in scandal than in truth. Within a fortnight, it had reached the village near Thornwick Hall, threatening the very thing Juliana had built to protect women like herself. Donors who had promised support for the training house grew suddenly cautious. A family who had arranged to send their dismissed kitchen maid for instruction withdrew the girl, rather than risk association with talk of impropriety. Juliana read the news of each small withdrawal with a tightening in her chest that felt uncomfortably familiar, the old, well-worn fear that no matter how far she'd traveled from that ballroom floor, the world would always find some new way to decide her worth without consulting her. She thought, briefly and bitterly, of how easily a single careless sentence in London could undo months of careful, patient work. Work that had nothing to do with scandal and everything to do with women learning, for the first time, that they were permitted to ask for better treatment than they had received. She refused, sitting alone with the letter in her lap, to let that old fear win the argument it was trying so hard to start in her. Gideon's first instinct was to fight the rumor directly, to write to every paper that dared print it, to confront every drawing room where it was whispered, to use the full weight of his title to crush the lie before it could spread further. Juliana stopped him before he had finished drafting the first letter. "You cannot answer every whisper in London," she said, taking the unfinished page gently from his hand. "If you try, you will spend the rest of your life fighting shadows, and you will teach every woman who hears of it that her reputation is something a duke must defend on her behalf, rather than something she may stand behind herself." "Then what would you have me do?" Gideon asked, and there was no irritation in the question, only genuine uncertainty, the particular vulnerability of a powerful man asking, sincerely, to be guided rather than to guide. "Stand beside the truth," Juliana said, "not in front of it. Let me speak for myself." She did exactly that at the formal opening of the training house a week later, standing before villagers, donors, and the women who had already begun to call the cottage home, in a plain gown with her chin level and her voice steady in a way it had never quite managed to be in 3 years of careful, silent service. She did not present herself as a ruined woman rescued by a kind duke's charity. She presented herself as a woman who had survived because once someone had finally chosen to believe her, and who intended for the rest of her life to make certain other women did not have to wait as long or fall as far before they were heard. The crowd that had gathered in the small garden listened in a silence that felt, to Juliana, entirely different from the silence that had once greeted her on a ballroom floor. This silence leaned forward rather than away. She saw Phoebe near the front, openly crying, and Clara beside her gripping Eliza's hand, and even a few of the donors, who had grown cautious in recent weeks, standing with their skepticism visibly softening as she spoke. She had spent 3 years learning to make herself small enough to go unnoticed in rooms far less important than this one. Standing here, in the open, with her own voice carrying clearly over her own garden, she discovered that she did not particularly miss the smallness. "No woman should have to break before she is believed," Juliana said to the gathered crowd, and the words carried across the small garden with a weight that silenced even the skeptics who had come expecting to find fault. "I broke. I do not intend to let that happen to the women who come through these doors if I can help it." Gideon spoke after her, briefly, and made certain that no one present mistook the nature of his support. He did not call her his charity. He did not call her his secret. He called her, simply and plainly, the founder of the training house, a woman who had earned her position through courage and clear sight rather than through any gift of his. He did not propose to her in front of the crowd, though several in attendance clearly expected it. That restraint, Juliana understood later, was its own form of respect, a refusal to make her independence into a performance for other people's satisfaction. It was that evening, with rain falling soft and steady over the village, that Gideon came to her door alone, carrying nothing more dramatic than a book she had once mentioned wanting to read, months ago, in a conversation she had half forgotten, and he clearly had not. "I have spent my whole life learning how to command a room," he said, standing dripping on her threshold, his gloves not yet removed. "You are the first person who has ever taught me how to listen." "I will not be hidden," Juliana said, stepping back to let him in. "Not now, not ever again." "Never," Gideon agreed. "And I will not be made grateful for being loved," she added, "as though love were as a debt I must spend the rest of my life repaying." "Then let me be grateful instead," he said softly, "that you allow me to love you at all." He removed his gloves slowly, watching her the entire time with an expression that held nothing of pity and everything of plain, uncomplicated wanting, the look of a man who had finally stopped mistaking restraint for the whole of what he felt, and had simply allowed himself, at last, to want. He did not kneel this time, the way he had on a ballroom floor months before. He simply asked, quietly, whether she would consider becoming her his wife, not because he believed himself capable of rescuing her, for she had long since proven she required no rescue, but because he wanted, plainly and selfishly and honestly, a life built beside her, rather than apart from it. Juliana did not answer at once. She looked past him, through the rain-streaked window, to where the lights of the training house glowed warm against the wet dark, the home she had built with her own hard-won freedom, the future she had chosen for herself before anyone had offered her a single thing in return. Then she looked back at Gideon and gave him her hand. At dawn, with the storm finally past and pale light spreading clean and quiet across the grounds, Juliana walked the path between the cottage and the training house without need of a cane, the old injury finally healed into nothing more than memory. Gideon walked beside her, not ahead of her, the way a man walks before someone he intends to lead, not carrying her, the way he had carried her once across a ballroom floor, while 200 people looked away. Simply beside her, matching his pace to hers, content to walk wherever she chose to go. Somewhere behind them, smoke rose thin and pale from the training house chimney, and the sound of Phoebe's laughter drifted faintly through an open window, and the whole quiet morning seemed to Juliana to hold its breath in much the same gentle way the ballroom once had, only this time for an entirely different reason. Juliana thought, as the morning light spread gold across the wet grass, of the girl who had once crawled across cold marble because no one in that glittering room would so much as look at her pain. She thought of how far that girl had traveled, through fear, through fire, through a slow and careful kind of love that had never once asked her to disappear in order to be kept safe. Now she walked beneath an open sky, on her own 2 feet, toward a life she had chosen freely, and a love that had finally, fully, learned to see her. She had never needed saving. She had only ever needed someone willing to believe her. And at last, she had found him. And that's Juliana and Gideon's story. If you stayed until the very end, thank you. Truly. Stories like this only reach more people like you when you help them along. So if Juliana's journey moved you, hit that like button right now. And if you haven't already, subscribe so you never miss the next one. Share this video with someone who needs a reminder that the right person will believe you, even when the whole room won't. And before you go, drop a comment and let me know where in the world you're watching from. I read every single one, and I love seeing how far these stories travel. Thank you for spending this time with me. I'll see you in the next story.